this. If you haven't signed in by checking your name on the roster, please do so. If you don't find your name on the roster and you have registered, put your name at the bottom of the roster. I'm going to reprint it for next week. If you haven't registered, please do so, and then put your name at the bottom of the roster. If you want CEUs, you need to do two things. Fill out an orange card and then give it to me or leave it there so that I get it, and put your name on the CEU roster. If you want CEUs, each week, you put your name, you put the date, and then you initial it. All right. So, any questions before we get going? Anything you need to know?
About the book.
I'll talk about it in a bit. Fred.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about your getaway.
My getaway? Did I get away?
Yes.
You said you were going to do something.
Yeah. All right, I'll tell you that story super quickly, which is... come middle May, I'm so burned out, I'm standing in front of large groups of people, I cannot tell you. And I look forward to having time to do whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted to do it, and to backpack and do all these great things. And a friend of mine needed help this summer, for the whole summer, intensively. And so I had to give that up and just help another person. And I thought it was going to be bad. I thought I was going to resent it. But I gotta tell you, this cognitive psychology stuff really works. I'm in better shape now than I'm usually in the fall. It really, even though I work really hard, it really makes a difference to give up yourself. It really does elevate you, enlarge you in some way. So I have a fulfilling summer, though I would not choose it again. But thanks for asking. Okay. We have a great deal to do today, of course. But to start with, I wanted to introduce Carl Blasius, who is a class member and a teacher at CLL, to talk to you a little bit about his classes.
Just about that close. Thank you, Chairman Professor. I talked to earlier version of the Professor's class about developments in biology, primarily, and it evolved into a couple of classes that I've taught for a year now, and one is Prospects for a Longer Healthy Life, and the other one is Aging in the Brain. The one on aging in general, Prospects for a Longer Healthy Life, starts next Tuesday, and I've been offering two sections, one during the morning and one in the evening, because people have told me that sometimes they want to come just during the day, they don't want to go out in the evening. They might come in the evening because they're working or have obligations. So we're going to try offering two sections, same class, and then the Aging in the Brain class, which turned out to be quite popular, is offered on a series of classes on three Saturdays, so it's a weekend seminar. So I'd like to invite you to try it out. I've survived a whole year doing this.
And the Tuesday class from where? The Tuesday class.
Well, the Tuesday class is here. They're both at Chop Center.
What time in the morning?
9:30 to 11:30 next Tuesday, or 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And hope some of you will join me. There's exciting new developments in how our body works and how we age every week.
Thank you, Carl. Carl is a remarkable guy, and what you'll find in that class is an understandable look at really the leading edge research. So he can translate. And he'll translate without trivializing things, and he'll do it in a way that makes you understand what these amazing developments are. And the developments are amazing. So it's a real mind-boggler of the class. So if you have any interest in the subject, and especially if you're kind of a science person, that's where to be. It really is. While I'm talking about this, before we go, we're going to meditate in a minute. Len, you want to go?
May I announce a class I'm doing tomorrow?
Yes. Tomorrow, yes.
A little bit different than Carl's. So I'm in my 35th year being an adult ed instructor, or CCL instructor. Tomorrow, doing a workshop from 9 until 1 on estate planning. And it's my co-teachers are a financial planner and an estate planning attorney, and I do the aspects of real estate in regards to estate planning. This will be at the Wake Center, 901.
Okay, so,
thank you.
I think I've used this. The two people whom you just heard from, one is called Blasius, B-L-A-S-I-U-S, B-L-A-S-I-U-S. And the other is Lenny Jarrett, J-A-R-R-O-T-T, J-A-R-R-O-T-T.
I cannot do this. All right. Mike Superman. You need me to do that? I think I can do it better this way. Mike's Mind and Supermind is on, I think, October 12th, Monday, October 12th. Got to tell you about this, just really briefly. Only 120 people can get in. It's going to be here. Who is Peter Nelson? Somebody that nobody ever heard of. He's not somebody on the circuit. He's never done this before. He used to live in Santa Barbara, I guess in the 80s. And used to go to Mind and Supermind. So when we phoned him in Australia and said, "Would you come to Mind and Supermind?" he said, "Oh my God, how strange to be going, you know, speaking of the very thing that I used to go to." He used to live in Santa Barbara, but now he lives in Australia. So how do we know about him? Somebody, I guess a friend of his, handed Andy Harper a self-published book that Peter published last year. And Andy didn't want to fit, so he said it looked interesting, so he handed it to me, and I started reading it, and I was blown away. So this guy is maybe 70, grew up, I think, on Long Island, got a really good technical education. I thought we went to school, but he's really, really technically educated, makes his living doing technological kind of stuff. He's a very hard-headed guy. But he found out, or he noticed when he was a very young child, that he seemed to have this strange ability to look at people and be able to kind of see what was wrong with them, and see their field, and see what was going on in a way that made no sense by physics. And so he kept it really quiet when he was going to school. But since that time, he's been investigating it and using it more and more, and trying to reconcile it with what he knows about science. And he's going to kind of do all that in one presentation. So he's the real deal. We talked with him, and I'm convinced that he's going to give, if anybody is a seer and can tell you about it in a way that won't put you off, he can do it. So I think he's amazing. He's a real, you know, again, I've never met him. I don't know what's going to happen, but I think it's a pretty good $15 bet. And when it fails, it fails. So it's October 12th, Monday, October 12th. Looking forward to it much.
How many seats are left?
There were 60 people registered already, so 60 more people, and then it's over. October 12th. Peter Nelson. Okay, a year without war. Usually we would have so many announcements. This is the first class, but I'm talking quickly, and then we'll go right into it. Okay, so a year without war. 2 years ago at Santa Barbara City College, a group of students and faculty from the philosophy department decided they were going to start an organization that was going to change the world. The spearhead of this is Joe White, the chairperson of the philosophy department. In any event, their first presentation was right here to our class. And what has happened since is they have partnered with various organizations and municipalities like the city of Santa Barbara, see Lompoc, I think, saying, yeah, this is a great idea. The goal is to get 1/10 of the world's population. Why am I yelling? The goal is to doesn't do anything. The goal is to get 1/10 of the world's population at that point in the year 2020. 800 million people, to just say, yeah, good idea. Why don't we declare a truce for 1 year anyway? Because it's a realizable goal as opposed to world peace, which is, I mean, nobody's, you know, that's too inconceivable. So at least they're going to focus on 1 year. As of last spring, there were 30,000 people already said yes, so they're growing by leaps and bounds. They're going to go to the United Nations next month, They need to raise some money. I think they need to raise $1,500. Oh, they have a matching grant now, so they need to raise half of $1,500, I think, in order to send the kids and the professors to the United Nations. If you are not a member already and would like to join, you go to ayearwithoutwar.org. ayearwithoutwar.org. Just join. They'll send you an occasional email. You can give them money if you want. You don't have to. They just need your name saying yes. ayearwithoutwar.org. And tell other people also because, why 800 million people? Or why a large number of people on the internet? Because when you get a sufficient number of people saying yes to something on the internet, two things happen. People pay attention, you get sponsors who really give the money, you know, because this is an organization that has to be built. And also, when it gets big enough, it pressures governments. So that's the idea, is from the ground up, we can change what can't be changed from the top down, or won't be changed from the top down. We're going to sit in a minute. If you know how to do mindfulness, this is just another practice session. If you don't, I'll guide you a little bit today. If you want more guidance, you go to my website, drspencersherman.com, and there's a bunch of written and auditory materials for you there. The latest thing, folks, for those of you who know you should meditate, but I once wrote a book called I Know I Should Meditate, But, right? For those of you who know you should meditate, but I keep trying to get it more brief, more succinct. Well, we just did a CLL Look and Learn video. We being Ken Harris, the associate director of the CLL, and myself. It's 2 minutes long. It's called Stress Release and Mindfulness in 2 Minutes. And believe it or not. And we remixed it, Paul, so that now the sound is down so you can actually hear my voice. The first time you're going to look at all the weird graphics and my closed-eyed face. Second time, please close your eyes and actually do it. Don't just look at the stupid graphics. No, they're not stupid. They're nice. But if you have only 2 minutes and you want guidance in releasing stress and at least being a little mindful in 2 minutes, just go to CLL.org and look, listen and learn, find the stress release and mindfulness in 2 minutes. You can also get it on YouTube. If you want, 2 minutes is not enough. If you want to do your own meditation, put it on for 2 minutes and then just keep going. It sets you up. If you need my voice, do it twice. But if you do it once, you'll be ready to go for 5 or 10 more minutes because it gives you all the instructions that succinctly. Okay, so Pepe.
If you want to stretch your notes,
spring
for a second panel for the people on that side. I wish we could all pay $1 and buy one because
the stores are sold out. The stores are sold out.
Okay, so. Okay, about the way I have to turn this off for right now. I'll turn it on again when we sit, but it's too loud for talking over. I called them about the weather, but they just did not return my email. Okay, it's better than otherwise. We'll do the best we can with it. If you need to leave a little bit to go out to the cool, do so. The fans don't really make much difference. We'll do the best we can. This is your initiation, right? If you can make it through this, it's all downhill from here, or it's all uphill from here, or something like that. It's all transcendent from here. Okay, anything else I need to tell you? No. So, if you don't know how to do mindfulness, that's it.
Some people are, yeah.
Oh, I should tell you what the class is. I'm sorry. A little preamble, and then we'll do this. For many years, many of us have been in a class that keeps changing its name. It has been called Consciousness Class, and it will again be called Consciousness Class in the winter. But this fall, I decided to call it something different and have more of an ongoing focus. Though I will sneak in Consciousness Class stuff the whole time. The idea with Consciousness Class was to become more conscious of yourself within you become more conscious of who you are and how you operate, and to become more conscious of what around you is influencing how you operate and the world operates. So inner and outer awareness. We'll continue to do that, but we're going to focus especially this term on positive psychology and what it teaches us about well-being. So some of us have been doing this for a long time, and we've been practicing mindfulness for a long time. Others of us, mindfulness might be entirely new to you or somewhat new to you. Each Friday morning, we'll start class with mindfulness. And then after that, we'll do whatever the lesson is. So that's what we're going to do now. What is mindfulness? Mindfulness is a new capacity that you're wiring into your brain. It's a new ability that your brain potentially has that it needs to practice in order to realize. What is that capacity? Instead of being identified with, caught up in, defined by thoughts, feelings, and sensations. You know, you ask a person out there, who are you? They'll say, I'm my thoughts, I'm my feelings, I'm my body. That's somewhat true, but not centrally true. It is possible to take one step back from personality and body and realize them. Notice that those things are happening, but realize that there is an awareness underneath thoughts, feelings, and sensations, which is the truer, more central, more constant you. So how do you take this one step back? That's what we're all practicing. How do you wire this capacity into the brain? Keep returning attention to your breathing, no matter what else is happening. And every time you get lost in thought, or caught up in a feeling, or preoccupied by a sensation, you remember, oh, where's my breathing? Oh, there's my breathing. You take a step back. You're pulled out of absorption into awareness of your breathing. Ah, oh, there's my breathing. Ah, oh, it's so nice. It's such a good thing. You're back in your thought, you know, thinking about your breathing. You come back out. And with practice, you can stay aware of your breathing, noticing the drama, the me show, without being unduly upset by it or captivated by it or defined by it. It's not that you don't have your personality and your body, it's that those things don't constrain you, they don't narrow you into them. You're a larger process in which these aspects of experience appear and disappear. So that's the theory, practice. Okay. The good news is, I'm not going to talk you through it with a lot of words, because some of you have heard too many of my words. Okay. So I'm just going to set it up and then give you about 5 minutes to practice on your own. So it'll be about 5 minutes of me leading you, about 5 minutes of practice on your own. Is it too much?
No.
Is it too little?
Yes.
I'll do the best I can. I'll bring you some food. Okay. All right, here we go.
So, how's that volume? Pretty good?
Too loud?
How about like that? Like this? If it's too loud, yell too loud. I'll try to remember to keep it about here. Is this good for people? Yes, good. Okay. All right, so sit upright, but not rigidly. So you're comfortable but upright. Both feet on the floor. If your shoes are pinching your feet, loosen them or take them off. If you can't breathe because your belt is too tight, then loosen your belt or whatever is preventing you from breathing and feeling. Otherwise, it's just going to be a struggle. You can do this with your eyes open, looking down if you choose, and I've experimented with that. But generally, people like to have their eyes closed because they can relax better and they can focus on their experience better. So close your eyes if you choose to. And just feel that you are breathing. Don't try to change the breathing, just feel that you are breathing. Feel what it feels like to be breathing. If you prefer not to focus on your breathing, focus on hearing instead. It will do the same thing. I will use the breathing, but if you want to translate that to focusing on what your ears are picking up, you can do that equally well. You will notice, as you focus on your breathing, that your whole body participates subtly in your breathing. That is, the most obvious thing that's happening is your belly and, to a lesser extent, your chest are rising and falling with your breathing. So the front of your body is opening and closing gently with the breathing. If you really pay close attention, you'll discern that not only is your abdomen and your chest, are your abdomen and your chest rising and falling, but the entire body is participating. That is, with the in-breath, the head and neck come up just slightly. The arms and shoulders and hands turn out just infinitesimally. The legs and feet even open even more infinitesimally. But you really can perceive that the whole front of your body is opening and closing, rising and falling with the breathing. Similarly, you can feel your back opening and closing, rising and falling with your breathing. And you just rest your awareness on your breathing. You're not trying to change anything. You're just relaxing and noticing the rhythmic rising and falling, opening and closing of your body as you breathe. If you're holding any tension in your face, let your face relax completely. Let your face soften and open. You don't make this happen, you just invite softness and openness in your face. And at the same time, you remain aware of the whole breathing process. Let your body soften and open. If there's tension anywhere in the body, let it release itself. So your neck and shoulders soften and open. Your torso, your pelvis, arms and legs and hands and feet all soften and open. And you're just releasing, you're just letting go, you're just relaxing and allowing this opening process to happen. You're not making any effort, you're just resting your attention on your breathing and allowing progressive softening and opening to take place in your face and body.
Similarly, soften and open your mind. So your mind is spacious, and thoughts can come and go as they wish. So as your mind softens and opens, it loses its boundaries, it just becomes completely open in all directions, in all dimensions. And thoughts can come and exist and leave on their own. You just notice them, you don't try to do anything about them. And you continue to be aware of the breathing process. Let your feelings come and go. So open your torso and your whole body so that feelings can arise, can do whatever they do, and can leave. So that sensations can arise and then fade away. To be just opening your body so that your body is spacious and thoughts, feelings, and sensations can come, you can notice them, and they can leave. You just keep returning attention to your breathing, softening and opening body and mind. When you get caught up in something and you forget about your breathing, just bring your attention back to your breathing and soften and open around it. You'll hear my voice, you'll hear the bell in 5 minutes.
Trying to figure out a way to take the focus that is in this room and film it. Wouldn't be a very good film, but there are a whole lot of us, and this is an uncomfortable physical situation. The focus is unbelievably good. I mean, so you're in an extraordinary company here, as you know. We will explore mindfulness week by week and see how it melds with the Western positive psychology approach. That's what this class is about. If you were lost in thought the whole time after my voice wasn't there, and you went, oh my God, I'm supposed to be paying attention to my breathing, at that moment that you came to your breathing, that was a moment of mindfulness. So it's not how often you get lost, it's how often you come back. That's important. And with practice, you get lost less frequently for less long, and you come back more efficiently. So don't criticize yourself for thinking you have a lifetime's habit there. And it's not that you won't think. It's that as you spend more time in this sky position, the weather will get better and it will be less preoccupied. But it's not that you don't have your personality. Those of you who know or have spent time with all these spiritual masters, they have personalities, and sometimes very strong ones. You know? It's not that they don't have a personality. It's that presumably when their personality gets a little not okay, they catch themselves and they come back to center, just like the rest of us. Okay, one thing about each week, I'll give you more about mindfulness. One thing that I want to mention to everybody, probably relevant to everybody, is when you're first learning mindfulness, you're probably pretty far along in that process. When you're first learning mindfulness for a certain amount of time, you don't get out of your thought process. What you do is you think better. One part of your mind says, look how you worry. You shouldn't be worrying so much. Notice that you are worrying. So there's a thought process commenting on another thought process and maybe trying to change that other thought process. That's good. That's progress. You're realizing what you're thinking and you're setting up more productive thoughts. But you're still on the level of thought. And people can stay on that level for a very long time because thought is very wired into us. But that's not the deeper understanding of mindfulness. Mindfulness isn't about thinking better. It's about actually coming out of that level of processing to something else that is getting wired into the brain. So you're not changing your thought process when you're more deeply into mindfulness. You're noticing your thought process from something other than thought. And that something other is pure awareness, natural mind, etc. You've heard all the terms for it. It's just a spacious capacity to have experience. And that becomes not a thought. After a while, that becomes an alternate way to move through the world, containing thought, but not being defined by thought. That's what we're practicing. That's a lifetime or lifetimes process. But do understand that there is an essential leap, which is the leap out of continual thought, even good thought. I know that makes sense intellectually. For some of you, it makes sense experientially. For the rest of you, it will. This is not, everybody can learn. It's just a question of putting in the time. So how much should you practice? Not so much as it becomes a burden. So if it's 2 minutes a day, 2 minutes a day. If it's 5 minutes a day, 5 minutes a day. I wouldn't start with a hyper-ambitious project because it will fall away. I would really do a little bit that you look forward to on a daily basis rather than trying to overpower mindfulness. Okay, any questions or comments before we move to positive psychology? Good. As questions come up, we'll take them, but today we've got a lot more to do. While I'm remembering this, on the table there is a red book, which is life stories. People have written a page or two either about their life or some incident from their life or a poem, and they give two copies to Donna. Donna, where are you? She puts them in a life story book. Well, actually, one copy, right? Well, because we only have one life story book, and then people can borrow that book. So it would be nice if everybody's voice was represented in some way in the red book. Robert. Oh, and it's also scanned on the website. Oh, swt.org. swt.org/Spencer Many of the previous classes are there for you to listen to. So if you have guest speakers, we've got all kinds of cool people come, go to swt.org/Spencer and see what you might want to listen to. If you're on a car journey and you want to listen to stuff and you can get the internet, go there, okay? So, it's a great resource that Michael and Robert give us. Thank you both. So, syllabus. Okay, so we have a course here, actually. That means a syllabus. So I'm about to pass the syllabus out. It will be exam. It's all suggested. If you aren't registered, don't take a syllabus until we make sure there's enough. I printed 100 up, and there are probably 100 people in here. So if you didn't register, you don't get to get a syllabus until you register, okay? And then there'll be enough. Also, I'm going to email this to everybody who's registered after class. So you have hard copy and you have email, okay? So, Chris, will you do the right side, not the left side, okay? And certain folks, we're not going to count. We're just going to give a bunch to each row, make sure it gets distributed and the extras come back, okay? I heard this word. extras come to me so that they can come down that way. We're going over this. You don't have to kind of memorize it right now, folks. So raise your hand if you need one. And if you have need one over your extras, where are the extras? Okay, you got extras over the people. Libby, you have extras? Okay, the people who need you, send them back this way. Twice for people who had registered as of 2 weeks ago and last week, but I didn't do a third email because so many people registered in the last couple of days, I thought I would see you here. So what you do is you go to Chaucer's to get a new one, or Amazon, or anywhere else where you get a used or new copy. Used one is perfectly fine, paperback is perfectly fine. Get Marty Seligman's book, Authentic Happiness. He's very available. It might cost $1.97 and $3 postage. It's really, it's all over the place, okay? And cheap. And the paperback is fine. We'll use that week by week. If you've already read it, we're going to read it probably in a little more depth, with a little more critical eye than you read it. And I've read it, and I'm reading it for the 15th time. And I'm still learning stuff. And I'm still disagreeing with them mightily about certain things also, as we've talked about. But it's a profound book. It's a perennial bestseller for reason, good reason. So please get the book. And suggested reading and exercise for the week. So if it takes you a week to get the book and you haven't done the reading for next week, don't worry. Just come to class, read it the week afterward. But by 2 weeks from now, everybody will be on board. I would suggest not reading ahead. You can, you can read the whole book if you want, but we're going to go over it in some detail. So if you read with us, as opposed to kind of flipping through the whole book, do what you want. But we will look week by week, and that's what I'm going to be doing, is reading week by week. Slowly and with thought. Oh, by the way, Marty Seligman, he's kind of the prime mover behind positive psychology. This is very, you're going to read this in Authentic Happiness if you haven't already. He coined the word positive psychology in 1998, though it had been used by Abe Maslow 40 years prior. In the year 2000, there was a special issue of the American Psychologist which introduced positive psychology to the psychological world. And in 2002, Authentic Happiness introduced positive psychology to the world. And it remains the go-to book. Not that it, I will update you, because a lot has happened since 2002, but the basic structure remains the structure of positive psychology. Martin Seligman was a philosophy major at Princeton, you know? He wasn't a psychologist till after. So he's really a philosopher, and this is really a philosophy book as much as a psychology book, which can bring up a lot of good discussion. And much of the philosophy is implicit in the writing and is explicit in the endnotes, which are kind of a whole other book. So you might want to look at those endnotes if you are more philosophically inclined, because that's where he gets to extatiate, that is, go in greater length into some of the things that he couldn't say in the book or didn't say in the book.
All right,
exercises for the week. Everybody has agreed from the beginning of positive psychology 15 years ago to now, or 17 years ago to now, that you can't teach this stuff if you don't apply it. If it's just stuff that's in your head, it doesn't make any difference in your life. So there are various exercises that have been developed that most are empirically supported, that is, they've been shown that they work. And I have chosen from those exercises ones that are immediately applicable to us or especially applicable to us. And so I suggest that we practice these together. That means some of these are just a one-shot deal. You just do it once. Some of these are daily exercises. And we'll talk about them each week. In my City College class in positive psychology, we actually sit around in a circle and we compare notes. We can't make a circle in this class, but I will pass the microphone around next week. We'll have a little, people can chime in about three good things. So the exercises are on the back of the syllabus. They're pretty self-evident. But I will talk about each one the week we're going to do it. So three good things. Each night before you go to bed, or any other time during the day that you like, you think of three good things that happened today and why you think they happened. Three good things that happened today and why you think they happened. And you either just say them to yourself, or if possible, write them down in a little, you might want to make a little positive psychology journal or your diary or something, but if you write them down, it kind of makes you, it makes it more salient. So you write down three good things that happened today and why you think they happened. First, and sometimes these are major things, sometimes these are very small things. If you've had a totally terrible day, you have to look very finely to find three good things. I have a hand to write with. I am writing under a roof. Good thing. Sometimes, you know. So you write down very briefly what happened and why you think it happened. You can be very brief about that also. Had a really good positive psychology class. Why do you think it happened? People who would come to such a class are already wonderful. End of story. Had a really good positive psychology class. People did not melt. Why? Grace of God. Anyway, 1, 2, 3. And do that each night for 2 weeks, I suggest. Maybe for the rest of your life. Some people, this is one that people really like and adopt, at least intermittently throughout their lives. But see what difference it makes. For some of you, it may make no difference at all. It's like a smorgasbord. If you do a smorgasbord, you're going to try everything. Some of these things are going to be things you're going to eat for the rest of your life. Some of these things you're going to have occasionally, and some of these things are disgusting. not really, but the point is that you're going to try these things, and then based on your own personality, you're going to adapt these things to be useful to you. But try each one. So three good things for next week. If you miss a day, don't worry about it. For some of you, you're going to go into why this happened a little more deeply. You just have to write, one little phrase about it. But some people are going to really go, why was this a good thing? Why did it make so much difference for me? And you're going to really get into it. That would be fine also. Robert?
Can you explain what you mean by why did it matter?
Last night in my positive psychology class, it had a really good feeling, even though the temperature in the room was 400 degrees. Why do I think it happened?
I'm not sure I know what you mean, but what kind of why?
It's a broad question. You can answer it at any level. So why I think positive psychology class went well last night? Because students who are going to take positive psychology are drawn to it because they're already positive people. So it makes it an easy group, So why did we have a class last night? Because it pre-existed. The capacity to have a good class pre-existed in those students. Right. That's all I'm going to tell you about the syllabus unless you ask me now. All right, then, plan B. Plan A was to close everything up, use the internet, and show you a TED Talk that some of you have seen before, that I showed it about 3 years ago in this class. Some of you have not seen. So you might want to, after I mangled it, you might want to go to TED.com and look at the talk by Daniel Kahneman. K-A-H-N-E-M-A-N. K-A-H-N-E-M-A-N. Daniel Kahneman. Who is Daniel Kahneman? Extremely briefly. I am Daniel Kahneman. I am about to become Daniel Kahneman. Because what I did is, I realized we couldn't close it up. People would die. So I transcribed this. It's already transcribed, but I did my own transcription. And I'm going to play Daniel Kahneman for the next 20 minutes or half an hour. Okay? I'm going to give the talk. As close as I'm ever going to get to a Nobel Prize. So Daniel Kahneman, except if my friend doesn't polish his. Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize, and he's the only psychologist ever to do so. And that's particularly surprising because there are no Nobel Prizes in psychology. So how did he win one? He won one for economics. He invented something called behavioral economics. He's a professor at Princeton. And what this is, in a nutshell, is the economic models mostly were based on, they made mathematical models of the economy, starting with a unit, U, and then they built these units into models which modeled aspects of the whole economy. The models were based on the units maximizing gain and minimizing loss. That is, you're going to act in a way so you get the most money and you lose the least money. But it turns out that's not the way human beings work. Human beings work emotionally, not rationally, a lot of the time. And so Kahneman, when he demonstrated this by many experiments, caused many of the models to be redrawn to include the idea that sometimes we will lose money in order to gain something emotional, or emotions will override our logic. The example I most often give of this is when you go to the store, and there's two brands side by side, one's the national brand, and one's the one that says compare to blah blah blah, and you look at the ingredients and they're exactly alike, and then you get the national brand because it must be better. That's an emotional decision, not a rational decision. They told you what was in it. It can't be better. Supposedly. Maybe it can be. But anyway, the point is that we react emotionally frequently, and that changes the way economists think of things. That's Daniel Kahneman's contribution, one of his contributions. Now.
Okay, now I guess I have to do this, because I'm going to leave that on. So he starts his TED Talk out by saying that everybody these days is talking about happiness. There are so many popular books on happiness. By the way, most of them are quite good, but the ones that I've seen. But there are three cognitive traps, ways of thinking about happiness that aren't accurate. Three traps we can fall into. First, the reluctance to admit complexity. That is, we talk about happiness as though it were one thing. But happiness has many different definitions, and depending on what we are looking at, we get very different answers for what promotes or builds that aspect of happiness. So he says happiness is a term we don't use much anymore, or it should be restricted, if we do use it, to one of its many possible definitions. He didn't go further than that, but I will go a little further. The definition of happiness that people in positive psychology are comfortable with is happiness in the sense of good feeling. Positive affectivity, A-F-F-E-C-T, positive affectivity. What that means is it's happiness in the sense of walking around with a smile on your face, having good emotions. That's what most people think about when they think about happiness. But that's not why Marty Seligman wrote a book called Authentic Happiness. What the premise is there are other aspects to happiness that actually are more fulfilling, more lasting, deeper, more satisfying. So that's where we're going to be going, is to, because it turns out that the positive affectivity part, the part about how smiley you are, it's not terribly modifiable. Some people are smile, they smile no matter what. They smile in 100-degree classrooms, you know. Other people are kind of dour, many positive psychologists included, throughout their lives, but it doesn't mean they aren't happy in deeper senses. So that's the first thing, a little bit of unwillingness to admit complexity. More generally, you've heard me say this before, where's Bob? Is Bob Weber here? Bob gave us a class in complexity theory, which was very complex. But what he said, essentially, was people, because of the way we think, we look for simple answers. We look for the Republican candidate to say, if we do this, the country will change for the better. We look for the Democratic candidate to say, if we do this, the country will change for the better. And for complicated things and complicated systems, which most things are these days, there are no simple answers. There are many variables interacting in unpredictable ways, and unless you understand chaos theory, complexity theory, you don't realize that it's going to take a lot of people answering on a lot of levels to fix these things, and not some glib politician or somebody else saying, oh yeah, I got the answer. That's dumb. So complexity theory is slowly making its way into our understanding of how things work. An example of this that I give is past about 2 or 3 days, and sometime in Santa Barbara, about 10 minutes, nobody can predict the weather. I mean, the weather, you know, first of all, it's hard to do because it's a strange place, but very strange place. But why can't, with all these mathematical models and big computers, why can't they predict the weather out any further? And the answer is because there are so many variables interacting in unpredictable ways, it just can't model it, at least with our current understanding, past a few days with any kind of reasonable accuracy. That's an example of a complex system, the weather, being difficult to understand and control.
Okay.
Second cognitive trap about understanding happiness is what his talk is going to primarily be about and what my talk will be about. So we'll come back to that. Basically, it's the difference between our experiences, and some of you will remember this, between our experiences and our memory of our experiences. And that's what, the reason I'm going to emphasize this is because throughout the rest of this term, we're going to be looking at a lot of data. The question is, what kind of data is this, and can we trust it? And the answer is sometimes no, even though it's made in some. Sans some. Third, we can't help but distort whatever we focus on. Whatever we focus on, we're not very good at accurately looking at our own thought and emotional process. We misjudge things all the time. An example that frequently given is when I ask college students who have just been broken up with, how long are you going to be unhappy? They always say months or years or forever. But it turns out that it's usually days or weeks. We're not very good at predicting our emotional reactions or assessing the state of our reactions in the past. We're not very good at self-reflection in that aspect. Okay, so then the example he gives is a man reports at one of his talks that, tell me if this ever gets wrong, tell me, okay? So a man reports in one of his talks that he listened to a gorgeous recording of a symphony. unbelievably beautiful recording, and at the very end of the symphony, there was a dreadful screeching noise from his playing device. And he said, it ruined the whole experience for me. But as Kaplan says, it didn't ruin the experience for him. Well, it didn't ruin the experience. He had 20 minutes of glorious music, and he had a bad ending. And somehow the ending colored his memory of the entire experience. So this, what this suggested to Kahneman is that there are two selves. This is the meat of this. There are two selves that we walk around with. We walk around with an experiencing self and a remembering self. The experiencing self is the one that the doctor addresses when she says, how do you feel right now? The remembering self is the one that the doctor addresses when she says, how have you been feeling? Thinking back on the past. And they give very different answers, and it turns out that the remembering self is really the one that's in charge. So Kaplan says, the remembering self is the one that keeps score and has the story of our life. The experiencing self is the one that is directly in touch with what's happening now. So then Kahneman puts on a slide, which I will go
on. Okay, here it goes.
Hang on.
Wait, the problem is that this doesn't work, so I have to figure out some clever way to erase the board, which I'll do right now. No, it's okay. I can do it with this, I think.
Is that really left over from the spring?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, it's not working.
Wow, that's scary.
So maybe, let's do the other, let's see if I can flip it over the other way.
I need to make you a little bit of perhaps easy.
Yeah. All right, let's see. Think good thoughts. Yes! I guess that got baked in from, they...
Maybe it was the wrong plan.
Maybe, but I mean, I generally...
but maybe somebody...
Maybe, or something. Maybe this way. That's maybe why it's left over, because nobody can get it off. They'll remember us. Right, so here you go. Get this math on. These are two colonoscopy patients, okay, from the 1990s. As Kahneman says, nowadays it's not just a painful procedure, but it used to be then. So these are two colonoscopy patients. This is the amount of pain that they are experiencing at each moment. This is 0 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. This is the rating of pain from 0 to 10. you notice that it's pretty painful. It gets more and more painful as the scope is moved, and then it's the end of the thing. So this patient A, got this much total pain. Those of you who do integral calculus in your head, you can probably calculate the area under the curve. That's the total amount of pain, right? They tell me. Patient B, the colonoscopy went on way longer, but it ended with less pain. Who got more total pain? This is a quiz. How many? Which under the curve? Which is more under the curve?
B.
That is totally obvious. But if Kahneman asks these two people, how bad was that? This one will say it's a lot worse than this one. And when he asks them later, how willing are you to have another colonoscopy in 5 years? This one will say, get out of here. And this one will say, yeah, that'd be all right. Why? When this one had more pain than this one. One more study, and this will give you the answer. You can take this guy, and they did this also. These are actual experiments they did. You take somebody like this, and then what you can do is you can extend the colonoscopy a few minutes, but don't jiggle the scope very much. So then their colonoscopy has more total pain, but the end of it is less. You know, it comes out this way. And that person will now say, oh yeah, that's perfectly okay. So what this shows is a violation of hedonic theory. Hedonic theory is we walk around assessing the number of good and bad, and that's how we live our lives. The most good, the least bad. That's hedonics. Turns out that's not the way we live our lives. We live our lives based on looking back at what happened and making a story about it. And what's the most important part of the story? How it ends. So, because this one ended better than this one, we are more likely to say that was a good story. Because the symphony ended badly, he's more likely to say it was terrible, it ruined the whole thing, when it didn't. So Kahneman says, by the way, if you're a creative writer or a filmmaker, Kahneman says stories are defined, now again, stories are the remembering self, as opposed to the direct experience of the experiencing self. Stories are defined by changes, significant moments, and endings. Changes, significant moments, and endings. So when we look back on a relationship with somebody, we're not assessing accurately what happened moment to moment in that relationship. We're focusing on how it ended, what the significant events were, and what the major changes were. And that may skew our view of relationship. To leap ahead, what's the correlation between what experience says about something and memory says about something? About 0.5, which is a moderate correlation. That is, it's not that you're totally in the dark about what happened. It's that you're not very accurate about what happened, depending on what it was. 0.5 is a moderate correlation. Actually, it's fairly weak. It explains about 25% of the variance. 0.5 by 0.5 is 0.5. So it explains a quarter of the variance. That's pretty weak, actually. Then Kahneman says, whoa, wait a minute. If the remembering self is the one that's making decisions about whether to have a colonoscopy or not again, and it's not accurate, what about the moments of experience we have? And Kahneman says, well, the answer is very simple. They're lost forever without a trace. Our moments of experience, they generally, you can't carry them forward. You can only carry the story of them forward. So how many moments of experience do we have? This is one of my favorite statistics. In an 80-year life, so you can add some to it, hopefully. an 80-year life, the psychological present is said to be 3 seconds long. Now, I have no idea where they get that from. Why the psychological present is 3 seconds long, but the Nobel Prize winner says it, I'll at least anybody would advise you. Psychological present is 3 seconds long. How many psychological present moments do we have in an 80-year life? Anybody calculate that real quick? 600 million. There are 600 million 3 second present moments in an 80-year life. In a month, there are 600,000. So 600 million present moments in an 80-year life. What I say from a mindfulness perspective is it is not only possible, it is common to never be there for any of them. That is, from an early age, you walk around in an idea of your life. You walk around in life filtered through your interpretation of life. Remember I told you about my one enlightenment experience? Small though that was, when the filter that usually is between me and the world was gone for a couple of hours, and it was just direct experience, when you are mindful, you begin to make the distinction, and then you do make the distinction between your idea of what's going on and the actual direct perception of it. And we have that distinction all the time. You hear a sound, and then you think about it. For the instant that you heard the sound before you labeled it, that was direct perception. And then you labeled it, and you were into an interpretation, an abstraction. We mostly walk around entirely in abstraction. And mindfulness is so difficult because we're coming out of abstraction into direct experience. And the difference is more different than anything else. I mean, it's stunningly different. But at the beginning, when you're still thinking, you think you understand the difference. Michael?
What about our perception of now being influenced by our past and their story? Like, for example, they say you can't know pleasure without pain, without knowing pain. So even when you're asked, what is your pain on a scale of 1 to 10? Aren't you kind of basing that on your past experience of pain?
Yeah, that's all thought, and now is all thought also. The question is, if you didn't have any of those ways of chopping up the world, what would your present experience be like? And that's where you read the spiritual masters about, and some far-out physicists, about the fact that it ain't the way you see it. It isn't linear. Time is a construction. It's not an actual fact. It doesn't go that way. The comparative mode is a mode of the mind. There's something else underneath that.
But I'm also thinking that the stories, actually, can't they shape how we feel about now within those 3 seconds? If we have a bad story,
no, what you can do is you can overlay onto the present moment your story, and that's what we do. But the present moment without story is not it doesn't have an overlay to it, it's just a direct experience. So if there's pain, there's an experience that you then label pain. It's just an experience at the moment, and you put it to a category when you think about it. This is easy to understand intellectually, not so easy to understand. So then he says, the biggest difference between the experiencing self and the remembering self is the handling of time. He considers a vacation. For the experiencing self, a 2-week vacation is twice as good as a 1-week vacation because there are twice as many good moments, right? So a 2-week vacation is twice as 1-week vacation for the experiencing self. For the remembering self, a 2-week vacation is barely better than the 1-week vacation because there are no new changes or significant events, or very few. So then he talks about I'll come back to that. So then he says, time has very little impact on our story. Then he says, the remembering self is the one that makes decisions. When you're trying to decide what vacation to take, it's not the experiencing self in charge, it's the remembering self making the decision.
We own horses. Now, this is a little profound for me, so I just quoted him. Okay, I'll just quote him. We don't choose between experiences. We choose between memories of experiences. We don't choose between experiences. When we're trying to decide what experience to have, we don't actually perceive the experience. We perceive our memory of the experience. I'm going to go back to that restaurant because it was a good restaurant. That's not the actual experience. It may correspond to the actual experience, but it's the memory that we make the choice from. And then he says, this is the one I don't understand. We think of our future as anticipated memories. We think of our future as anticipated memories. Then he says, we can think of the remembering self as dragging the experiencing self through experiences that the experiencing self doesn't really need. We can think of the remembering self dragging the experiencing self through experiences that the experiencing self doesn't really need. We go on vacations to a very large extent in the service of our remembering self. Now, then he talks about if after your vacation, they gave you an amnesic drug, I mean, you saw it on the pictures, would you still choose the same vacation? Because frequently you go on vacation and it's a hassle to get in the airport, and it's a hassle on the plane, it's a hassle when they get to the wrong room, and it's a hassle this, and it's a hassle that, it's a lot of money you have to do, and it's a mosquito bite, and you get home and you go, wasn't that a great vacation? And I got them home. If you didn't have that memory, wouldn't you just sit in the easy chair, watch Ted, read a book, sip a mint julep, you know, whatever, and wouldn't there be a different sort of decision? So how do you get information about the two different selves and their experience of happiness? For the remembering self, you ask, you say, how good was that? And they give you a self-report. We're going to talk about a self-report. You know, we don't have an emotional dipstick. We can't put a litmus paper in your mouth and say, oh, you're about a 7 on a scale of 10 happy. I mean, we don't have that yet. We're getting there. I'm going to tell you about the physiological measures of happiness that we do have. But the point is, mostly you have to ask people. When you ask people, get information. It's good information, but it's not great information. A lot of distortions of self-report. And a lot of what positive psychology is built on is self-report. So you have to kind of look at that with a critical eye. And next week, we're going to look at that with a very critical eye. But to find out what the remembering self experiences, you have to ask the person to tell you. For the experiencing self, what they do is they give people beepers. And, they used to give them beepers, now they just beep their cell phones. And once an hour, 12 hours a day, the thing goes off, and a little questionnaire appears, and you say where you are, what you're doing, who you're with, and 0 to 10, how do you feel? We have a lot of data points. Those are data points about your actual experience, as opposed to your self-report of your experience. Okay, so the remembering self, to the remembering self, what's important are money and achievement of goals. To remember yourself, what's important, money and achievement of goals. To the experiencing self, what seems to be most important is time spent with people that you like. Time spent with people that you like. Then he gives the example of people who live in Ohio and think about moving to California. And they think that if I go to California, I will be happier. And so some of them move to California. And if you ask them, are you happier and you were in Ohio, that's to remember yourself. They'll say, of course, the weather is so much better in Melbourne. You think it was so terrible in Ohio. I'm so much happier here. And for that moment, in fact, they will be happier. But if you give them a cell phone and you gather data moment by moment, you find out that they're not happier. That it turns out that your moment-by-moment happiness has a lot to do with your genetics. And what it doesn't have to do with your genetics, it has to do with your personality and how you learn to process the world. And in fact, it's wherever you go, there you are. So that's what I mean, you know. There I am in Hawaii feeling just as blue as I was, and you know, you carry yourself with you. But people make decisions, major life decisions, based on their remembering self and their estimation of how they're going to feel as opposed to how they actually do feel. So now the last thing I want to do is talk to you about. So that was the end of the TED Talk. And then Chris Anderson came on stage and basically said two things to Daniel Cameron. One of which was, if people understood what I'm about to show you, on a governmental level, it would change policy around the world. When are people going to wise up to this? And Cameron said, there are efforts being made to measure the moment-by-moment happiness of the population. Also efforts being made to measure the remembering happiness of the population. And based on those pieces of data, governments are starting to change their policies. Because right now, the policy is, in the United States and in many other places, make people richer and you will make them happy. That's the, we gathered information about economics, the gross domestic product, we try to up that with the presumption that that will make people happy. Is that actually true? Let me show you the latest research on money and happiness. And this is the nuanced view. The unnuanced view is money will buy happiness. But that's not true.
As Dan
Gilbert, the Harvard professor, says, if you think that's true, give me yours.
So here goes.
Are from the 2013 Gallup World Poll, so pretty current. So what they do is find out what people, this is the income for a family of four in the United States. And this is how happy people actually are. This is the beeper. This is not how happy they say they are. This is how happy they actually are as they walk around. And this is the experience of self-happiness. What they find is the following.
Well, it's not quite. People who are, there's a little bit of happiness even if you have nothing. I didn't quite do that right. It has to rise a little bit, and it's flat. As Daniel Kahneman said, I've never seen a flatter line. So, the deal is that for people who experience happiness, for a family of four in the United States, if you have nothing, your family is very happy, and you're not very happy, moment by moment. If you get $10,000, there's a big rise. Go from here to here. There's quite a rise in happiness from just a little money. If you go from $10,000 to $20,000, there's almost as big of a rise. When you go from $20,000 to $30,000, there's still a pretty good rise in happiness. You go from $30,000 to $40,000 less. Goes along at $75,000. So from difference between $60,000 a year and $75,000 a year, family of four, is a very small difference, and from then on, entirely flat. So, what's true is, money doesn't buy happiness, because $150,000 a year doesn't get you or your family any happier than $75,000. This is enough money in the United States to have what you want, basically. By the way, most people in the United States do not make $75,000 for a family of four, so there's a long way to go, even in this supposedly rich country, with one out of every six people below the federal poverty line. You know that. One out of every five people in the West below the federal poverty line. And that's $22,000 for a family of four or $11,000 for an individual. That's poor. And we've got a lot of people below that line. Anyhow, what this says is money doesn't buy happiness, but lack of money buys unhappiness. So it is true that as people get more economically well off, they do get moment-by-moment happy. To a certain level, beyond that, not at all. However, if you ask people, are you any happier now that you're making 100 grand a year than when you were making 50 grand a year? They will go, oh my God, are you kidding? Way out. Are you any happier making 200 than you were making 100? They will go, absolutely. The story keeps rising. But the actual fact of the experience itself does not. So what is being proposed by positive psychologists that we'll look at in more detail is why don't governments keep track of the moment-by-moment happiness of the population and make policy based on what raises that rather than keep trying to get everybody richer with the presumption that that will make people happier. However, it is also true that there's a long way to go before we get the average family of four up here, so there is some onus to raising the economic level of the average person in the country, not the people that have all the money in the country. Okay, the car.
We vote based on our memories rather than our momentary experience.
Which is why policy has to be set in such a way that it takes into account moment by moment experience. You know what I'm saying?
That will change your vote.
It will if the people that give you the choices understand the difference and build into our choices the possibility of doing what will actually make us happy. They right, but they don't do that now.
Okay.
All right. So I'm not Daniel Kahneman. If you go on TED, you can listen to him. But I hope, the reason I did this, the reason that this was so important is because when we look at what happiness is, we're going to be looking at two different conflated kinds of data. And we're going to have to parse them out to see, is this experience data or is this memory data? And if so, what difference does it make in our conclusion? Okay. Three good things for next week. You can start now. I think you'll find that, you may find that it has a little bit more life-changing power than 2 minutes at night, but let's see what you do with it, okay? See you in a week. I will email the syllabus to you.